And now, your hosts for Life from the Pulpit, here's Nick Perez.
That's right. You can't stop it. You can only hope to contain it. The fastest half-hour podcast in the West. This is Live from the Pulpit, coming to you live and local from deep in the heart of the San Joaquin Valley, deep in the heart of Merced Church of Christ. I am your guide on this excursion into theology and other sundry matters, the voice of the valley, Nick Perez, offering up news and views you can use on Scripture and society with a little help from my friends. Greetings. Welcome to the program. Glad you tuned in. I want to wrap up to a degree. I mean, there's an edge to this thing, which, quite frankly, I haven't found, concerning the Christian's attitude toward war. And again, this got started because of the comments made at the National Prayer Breakfast by our fearless leader, President Obama, which I think we pretty well dismissed fully as simplistic, his approach, his view of history. And then I broke down the two primary schools of thought concerning war among Christians, the idealist and the realist, or the pacifist versus the just war traditions. And I don't even know if versus is the right word there, because we really shouldn't be against one another. We're brothers, and I gave all of the Bible for each position in the previous episode. And I want to encourage you to go back and listen to that, because I simply don't have the time to run back through these. To sum them up, the pacifist position, nonviolent position, the idealist position, believes it's more blessed to suffer violence than to commit violence, whereas the just war tradition, the realist position, says that love and the pursuit of justice are not opposed to one another. They go hand in glove. And we can kind of get snarky about this and say, you know, with all the biblical data, I don't know how any Bible-believing Christian could fill in the blank, advocate for war or be opposed to war, because they both got Bible. And if nothing else, I would hope that we would respect one another in that and respect the conclusions that we're both brethren who seek to honor Christ, who are not seeking to be dishonest with the Scripture, but are seeking to form our lives according to Scripture. And I believe it is Herbert Ryle who summed this up very well. He said, whatever line the Church of Christ took, an appeal to the language of Holy Scripture could evidently be made on the other side. Yeah, you've got Bible for both positions. And so, I don't think it's fair to talk that way to one another. Well, my Bible says, well, yeah, we're reading the same Bible. And we're not really arguing about what the text says, we're arguing about what it means. Well, it means what it says. Really? And then when you say, well, then I guess you're going to be a pacifist, or I guess you're going to be one who supports war. Oh, no. I know that's what it says, but it's not what it means. Welcome to the conversation. So, what I want to do in this episode, I want to deal with the just war theory and see if I can't flesh this out. And this is something, if you trace the history of this, there were philosophers back in the day who were outside of Judaism. They were outside of the church. But they did argue about just war from a political standpoint, from the state standpoint, and the morality of waging war and those sorts of things. It was picked up. I'm sure there were rabbis, although I haven't seen any literature about this, but I'm sure there were rabbis who were making the case for a just war when it was right for the Jews to go to war. And I mean, you got a lot of war in the Old Testament. God commands his people to go to war, and then he regulates how they go to war, how they are to wage war. And so I'm sure there were some rabbis who were writing about it. You get to the Christian era, it's interesting because early on, a lot of the early church writers were pacifists. Clement of Alexandria, Origen, Tertullian. And that's for a reason. They were under the Roman Empire, and they thought serving in a military capacity for the Roman Empire, that was anathema. I mean, you had the Roman Empire that was oppressing Christians, persecuting Christians. How could you serve that evil empire? Well, when Christianity is legalized under the Edict of Milan in 312 by Constantine, all of a sudden the tone does kind of change. And you do have guys who begin to advocate and say, look, yeah, you can. The Christian can. The Christian can serve in military. Clergy probably shouldn't. But guys like Augustine, he's kind of the godfather of the just war theory. Aquinas comes on the scene. Augustine, by the way, 4th, 5th century. Aquinas comes on the scene in the 13th century and advances the just war theory. And then Hugo Grotius in the 17th century, he writes a work on it and pretty well distills it more from a legal rather than a moral perspective, the just war theory. And so this is a very rich tradition. And so I just want to break down some of the factors of a just war. For example, first of all, you need a just cause. And the purpose of your war must be just. It must be righteous. You just can't go into war willy-nilly, all right? There needs to be a right to wage war, because people could wage war unjustly and without justice. But if you're going to wage war, it must be for justice. And, you know, there are a number of causes that would be just, thereby making it morally permissible to engage in conflict. In fact, Thomas Aquinas, in his tome Summa Theologica, talks about how a just cause is required, namely that those who are attacked should be attacked because they deserve it on account of some fault. And he quotes Augustine to support that. So yeah, you need to have a righteous or a just cause. You need to be pursuing justice. And I'm reminded of what is said by Solomon, one of the wisest men to ever walk the planet, in Proverbs 24, verses 11 and 12, which I believe is instructive to this. He says, rescue those who are being taken away to death. If I might pause there, doesn't that sound like what's happening over in the Middle East with the Christians and ISIS? Yeah, they're being taken away to death. Rescue them. Hold back those who are stumbling to the slaughter. If you say, behold, we did not know this, does not he who weighs the heart perceive it? In other words, you can't just claim ignorance. We didn't know. We're just kind of left in the dark here. Does not he who keeps watch over your soul know it? And will he not repay man according to his work? So I'll sum it up, that cause. I'll say it's rescue the oppressed. Help the helpless. Defend the defenseless. Go and rescue those who are being taken away to death. Rescue mission. That would be a just cause. And another good reason would be love your neighbor. I mentioned this in the previous episode. Love your neighbor. How can you claim to love your neighbor while you just sit idly by as harm befalls them? You need to do something. And in fact, Ambrose of Milan, another early church writer, he makes a similar case. He's talking about the duties of the clergy, but listen to how he speaks here. He says, this is in his book On Duties of the Clergy, Book 1, Chapter 36, 179. The glory of fortitude, therefore, does not rest only in the strength of one's body or of one's arms, but rather on the courage of the mind. Nor is the law of courage exercised in causing, but in driving away all harm. See kind of where he's heading here? He who does not keep harm off a friend, if he can, is as much in fault as he who causes it. Wherefore, holy Moses gave this as a first proof of his fortitude in war. For when he saw an Hebrew receiving hard treatment at the hands of an Egyptian, he defended him and laid low the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. And then he quotes Solomon there from Proverbs 24, which I just read for you. But humanitarian intervention, I'll put it under that. Intervening on behalf of your neighbor. That's, you know, whether they deserve it or not, that's the point, right? That's the point of loving your neighbor, intervening on their behalf, because I think of stuff like Rwanda, genocide might fall under this category. You're going to intervene. How can you stand idly by while ill befalls them? That's kind of the question. Self-defense typically is argued for a just cause, like when an enemy attacks at dawn, crashing their planes into our ships, and all the while for weeks they had been feigning peace talks. Does that sound familiar? Pearl Harbor, a la 1941. Or like when planes come crashing into buildings, a la 9/11. Although some might argue, well, that was more retaliation than self-defense. Well, enter into this discussion anticipatory self-defense. You got a lot of guys who belong to that bolt of fabric, and we should strike because we believe that they're going to strike, they're going to attack imminently. Preemptive military strikes, anyone? All right. That might fall under here as well. Just cause. These are just a few, but there are more, I'm sure. You get the flavor, though, here. You need to have a righteous purpose, a righteous cause, just cause. You also need legitimate authority. Not anyone can just authorize the use of force. And in fact, Aquinas talks about this, the sovereign by whose command the war is to be waged. You need that authority. All right. He beareth not the sword in vain. That's talking about government. All right, that's talking about the sovereign, the emperor. They had kings back then. We have Congress and that sort of thing. You need the right authority. And then even here, you need to ask the question, well, how does the UN factor into this? Can nation states just wage war on their own? Can they do that? When we were attacked on 9/11 and we began our work in Afghanistan and stuff like that, the global community was silent. They let us do that. The UN. How does the UN? I know some would argue you got to get the U.S. out of the UN. Okay, whatever. But here's another question. How do you differentiate between the will of the sovereign and the will of the state? What happens when those two are in conflict? It's interesting. A lot of questions that come up when we start talking about legitimate authority. You know, if a sovereign wants to go in and take over territory, well, maybe that falls back into just cause. Is it just, is it right to wage war in order to gain territory? The guys back in the day, like Augustine and Aquinas, they said, no, that's not a just cause. You can't just go in and take territory. It's interesting, though, you go back into the Old Testament, Israel, when God commands them, apparently it's morally permissible under certain circumstances, it's a just cause to go in and take territory. That's interesting. Think on these things. You also need, third of all, the right intent. As one writer talks about it, a statesman who wages war must show that he has sought to avoid war, has the authority to do so, and that the war is waged for limited objectives. The intent, therefore, in waging war must at all times be the restoration of peace rather than any quest for territorial or self-enrichment. In other words, those who wage war must intend to promote good and avoid greater evil. Aquinas makes a similar statement. It is necessary that the belligerents should have a rightful intention so that they intend to the advancement of good and the avoidance of evil. And he quotes Augustine again in that. Yeah, we're promoting good. We want to restore peace. If someone has been messing up peace, well, the right intent, it must be to restore peace, it must be to advance good and to eliminate evil, maybe even punish evil. That's part of it as well. In the fourth place, and this is a big one, reasonable chance of success, it must be the last resort, and proportionality. All these kind of go together. It all has to do with calculation. All right, calculation. The benefits must outweigh the cost. Typically, peace, that's the benefit. We want to restore peace. Well, does that outweigh the cost? That's proportionality. Will the desired end be met? That's a reasonable chance of success. What are the odds that we'll be able to achieve our desired end? But even this, it was interesting as I was teaching through this, Last night, I had a question put to me. Well, aren't there certain causes worth fighting for, even though you may not have a reasonable chance of success? It reminded me of Winston Churchill. Before America got involved in World War II, he made a speech to his people and to Parliament, essentially waving the white flag. Maybe that's not even the right image, but he said, you know, look, we're going, our chance of success here, our chance of winning is virtually non-existent. But you know what? We're going to fight in the air. We're going to fight on the sea. We're going to fight to the very last Brit. Even though America, the strong man isn't involved yet, and though they may never, we are going to go this alone, and we're going to fight because there are certain things worth fighting for. Reasonable chance of success, what do you put that at? 75% chance of success? 90% chance of success? What, again, how do you quantify that? It all comes down to calculation with that. Will the good secured outweigh the bad that is incurred? That has to do with proportionality. Have all possible avenues of diplomacy been exhausted? That's last resort. This is it. This is... Well, what about one more peace conference? Yeah, you know, those kinds of questions enter into the fray as well. But does the worth of the cause outweigh the loss of life? There's your proportionality, a bit more of that. How rational? This is interesting. How rational are the people we are trying to make deals with? Are they even willing to come to the table? ISIS, they willing to come to the table and just... Not really. Again, these are questions that get factored into this. There's one more thing. It's called juice and bellow. And that has to do when you're actually in combat. How do you treat non-combatants and buildings and stuff like that? And the bottom line is, when it comes to actual justice and righteousness in war, non-combatants must be protected. This would be women and children, that sort of thing. You need to protect the weak among the people that you are waging war against. And when it comes to buildings and things like that, you need to avoid unnecessary destruction. Buildings and homes, we should avoid destroying their stuff. Every effort must be made to avoid direct or intentional harm of non-combatants. And also, military leaders need to avoid unnecessary destruction of buildings and territory and homes and that sort of thing. After all, who gets to clean that up? The winners. And we do. When we rebuilt Germany after World War II and all of Europe, we helped rebuild that after we won the war for them. You're welcome, UK. No, I'm just... But, yeah, that, so you want to avoid all this unnecessary harm, unnecessary destruction, and that sort of thing. So what happens? What happens when the bad guys use little children to wage their war? Strap bombs to little children. Tell them, go walk into that crowded area over there. What happens then? What happens when they use the mentally handicapped? And believe me, they do. Strap bombs to them. What happens when they hide their dirty bombs under the skirts of their women? Yeah, so much for juice and bellow. And again, we can't expect these evil bad guys to follow the rules. Do they ever? I'm a big fan of comic books, and I don't know of any time when the bad guys follow the rules. They break the rules. Well, how do we respond in that? If we're going to be just, if we're going to be righteous in conflict. What happens when the bad guys hide their WMD in elementary schools or in residential neighborhoods? That's the kind of evil that we face over in the Middle East today. In case you didn't know, they do that stuff. They exercise no restraint. They exercise no justice. They behead women and children. Does it matter to them? They hide their WMD in elementary schools and in their neighborhoods, and they use women and children in order to wage their war by strapping bombs to them and hiding dirty bombs under their skirt. That's evil we don't know in this country, folks. And you know what? Under the just war theory, it is generally accepted that it is right, it is just to use force, even in an offensive manner, in order to thwart and or punish evil. Are you gonna sit there and tell me that strapping bombs to little kids, mentally handicapped people and women is right? Isn't evil? Give me a break. Force should be used to punish evil and to relieve oppression. Charles Reed, in his book Just War, he makes this comment. He says, the overriding concern of the just war theory is to ensure the primacy of peace over war. If the aim of war is peace, then it is incumbent on those who wage war to articulate the peace for which war is being fought. Just war theory, it could be argued, seeks to bridge the gap between the Old Testament and the New Testament, between political idealism and political realism. It is neither realist or pacifist, but rather shares elements of both. And that's really the edge of this thing, at least where I'm at with this right now. Here are two questions, okay? Let's assume that, okay, we fall into the just war tradition category. We're part of the realists. There's war, and you got to fight the bad guys, and you need to use force to punish that and to relieve oppression. Okay, here's the first question. If we, as New Testament Christians, adopt that position, that in certain situations, certain circumstances, it is right and just to fight and engage in conflict and war, then what do we do with all the sayings of Jesus? Especially his sayings in the Sermon on the Mount. The pacifist takes them at face value for what they say. What do we do with them if we adopt that position? If we assume there are certain circumstances in which it is right to wage war, what do we do with those? I mean, is it a function of, well, Romans 12, verse 18, if it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all men and be peacemakers. And maybe to be a peacemaker, you do got to engage in conflict. Blessed are the meek. That doesn't mean you're a limp-wristed namby-pamby. It's strength under control. And sometimes you got to unleash the strength in order to... But then even the retaliation, if someone strikes you on the one cheek, turn the other also. How can you love your neighbor if you're pointing a gun at him and that sort of stuff? Maybe it's a function of that. Yes, that is what we are about. That is foundational. We seek peace. But there are times to make whips and go to battle and engage in conflict to drive out the bad people, the bad guys, a la John 2. Again, that's the edge of this thing. That's where I'm at. And now for the other side of this coin, let's assume we adopt a pacifist position. Nonviolent. If we, as New Testament Christians, say that we should not engage in violence whatsoever, no matter what, in any circumstance, then what do we do with all the Bible passages which seem to advocate for war, including those in the New Testament, even found on the lips of Jesus, even demonstrated by the Lord himself, the warrior king at the end of Revelation, coming in, conquering and to conquer, trampling underfoot with a lot of blood, the winepress of his fury. What do you do with those? And it's not just that, you know, the realist writes off those pacifist passages or the pacifist writes off the realist. This is real tension. And I don't think they're contradictory. Don't misunderstand. I'm not saying the Bible contradicts itself in the least. They may be nothing more than a contrariety, held in perfect tension. Well, that happens in Scripture all the time. You know, that we talk about divine sovereignty and human responsibility in the New Testament, holds those in perfect tension throughout the pages of the New Testament. So what do we do with that? How do you answer those questions? And I'll deal with that more in just a moment. But first, this half hour brought to you by Christian Book Distributors. As a preacher, I need good tools for Bible study. I mentioned a couple books already today in previous podcasts. Listen, you can get all your Christian books and Bibles at bargain prices with CBD, with a large selection of Christian fiction, kids' books, Christian music, DVDs, books, both classic works and contemporary, and of course Bibles, CBD is sure to have exactly what you need. Go online and visit christianbook.com or call 1-800-CHRISTIAN. That's 1-800-247-4784. Christian Book Distributors, serving the Christian community for over 30 years. And so the question of the day segment is two questions, right? If you're a pacifist, how do you explain the passages in Scripture that deal with war and even the moral permissibility of war? You can't say it's never morally permissible, because how do you explain Israel in the Old Testament? Or how do you explain Jesus commending the faith of warriors like the centurion in Matthew 8, parallel passage in Luke 7? And at the same time, if you're a just war person, if you say it's right in certain circumstances, war is morally permissible, you have to deal with the pacifistic teaching of Christ, for lack of a better term, especially in the Sermon on the Mount. How do you account for that stuff? These are the things that we need to think about, think soberly about. And again, if nothing else, I would hope. I had a brother last night in class, and he said, you know, I've got to respect the pacifist position, because here's the thing, that requires a lot of restraint, that nonviolent pacifist position. Unfortunately, I had someone else say, well, I just don't respect that position, because you gotta listen, if nothing else, we be brethren, let's at least respect one another. Fine, you think you shouldn't engage in any conflict whatsoever, fine, so be it, you're still my brother. And maybe they're both in the church for a reason. Maybe they temper one another. Maybe the pacifist takes the edge off of the guy who's willing to drive anyone through a wall. Shouldn't do that. But and maybe the just war guy is in there to help the pacifist understand, listen, sometimes you got to protect the weak among us. Fight off the wolves, so to speak. But here's another thing I thought of, and I'll close with this. I am persuaded that Americans would make poor martyrs. American Christians make terrible martyrs. Because as I taught through this material, based on some of the comments, especially last night, if ISIS were here in the States, most of us would take up arms and fight them. There's not a very strong, at least here, with this congregation. We got a lot of veterans, okay? I think that helps to understand where they're coming from. There's just not a strong pacifist, nonviolent contingency here. You could chalk it up to patriotism. You could chalk it up to survival instinct, whatever. American Christians, when reviled, would probably revile. American Christians, they would go kicking and screaming to death. That is, they would go kicking and screaming in order to meet their Lord in death, because to die is gain. American Christians, they'd go down swinging, which just seems to be more in line with worldly behavior rather than otherworldly behavior, Christian behavior. I don't know. That's just kind of my read on this. Think soberly about these things, brethren. At any rate, I'm out of time. Feel free to leave a comment on the website. I always like to hear what you have to say. Search Facebook, Life from the Pulpit. Like the Facebook page. You'll get all the updates when I go live with the podcast. Update the blog or post a new video on YouTube. Speaking of YouTube, search YouTube, Life from the Pulpit. Subscribe to the YouTube channel. All the Question of the Day segments are there and available for you to use and peruse in your everyday Bible study. Follow me on Twitter, @InPulpit. At the letter N is a Nick, Pulpit, P-U-L-P-I-T. Be sure and stop by the Life from the Pulpit blog, life from the pulpit.wordpress.com. All of my commentary there on Luke, James, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, John, now Philippians, all there, all available, all free for you to use and peruse in your everyday Bible study. Now on iTunes, search the iTunes store, Life from the Pulpit. Download all the episodes to your particular device. You'll never be more than a click away from the episode of the podcast. Be sure and check out Mercy Church Christ website, mercychurchofchrist.org, mercychurchofchrist.org. Plenty of sermon audio there for you to use and peruse in your everyday Bible study as well. And as always, brethren, grace be with you all. Thanks for listening.